Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books and Popular Culture, and today I am here with Patrick Maley, who is the author of The Cards, The Evolution and Power of Tarot. Patrick, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Can you start by telling us a little bit about how this book came about, how you got interested in tarot, and how you started to compile and put together this book?
Sure. Well, there are a couple of points to consider. My interest in tarot stems from a broader interest in the history of magic. So when I was a graduate student at Texas Tech University working on my dissertation in history, I was looking at magic and miracle and how they were viewed differently in the early Christian community. And an interest in magic kind of stemmed from there. I kept going. I teach a history of magic class here at Oklahoma Panhandle State University. But the book itself came out of a connection that was developed for me through my dean. And Brad Duren, has a good connection to the Southwest Popular Culture Conference in Albuquerque. It's a fantastic conference every year on all things pop culture. And I teach European history, but this is about American popular culture. And I wanted to present, if I'm going to the conference, I want to present a paper. And I struggled with the idea of what I could do at that conference. And I settled upon the idea of tarot cards and connected them to television. And so I really enjoyed doing that paper. And I, as luck would have it, I got contacted by Katie Keene of the University of Mississippi Press. And she asked me if that was part of a larger project. And it wasn't, but I thought if you want it to be, it will be. And so we started talking about a book, and that particular publisher has an interest in television, movies, and comics. And I thought, well, I can connect tarot to all three of those things. It'll work great for both of us. And so it just went from there.
And so in the book, you sort of start, you've divided it into sort of two parts. And the first is a bit of this history of tarot. And the first section and the first chapter is on that, the origins of the tarot card. So can you talk a bit about those origins and how they came to be? It seems in reading this and thinking about it, there is often misperception about tarot and how it came to be. So I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that.
Great. So one of the things that struck me the most is that the cards didn't originate as a magical device. There was no association with fortune telling. It was a game. And cards as, playing cards, the ones that we're familiar with for playing poker and stuff like that, these came from the Islamic world into the Christian world by way of Italy. And so during the Renaissance, cards were introduced, and the Italians came up with their own card game, and it was tarocchi, which is where we get our word tarot. But it was, as I say, just a game. And it was not until the 1700s, the so-called Age of Enlightenment, which is one of, you know, really cool periods in history. But it was in the 1700s that, around the time of the American Revolution, there was this Frenchman by the name of Antoine Corre de Gebelin. And he was an intellectual, and he was in Paris. And he happened to encounter these women from southern France playing this game, tarot. And he was intrigued with the pictures on the cards. And they had always, going back to the Renaissance, they'd always had some really interesting pictures on the, what we call the major arcana cards. And those pictures include like a woman holding the mouth of a lion open, representing strength, right? There's a card of the devil. There's one of the sun, and just a whole bunch of different cards that he was intrigued with. And Corre de Gebelin, like a lot of people in his time and his social milieu, had a bit of an interest in magic as a sort of a philosophical construct. And he felt that those images were actually far more significant than these common people playing the card game could possibly realize. And he theorized, without much foundation at all, that these cards were actually a book. The individual cards were like pages in a book, and they contained hidden information that only brilliant people like he could see. And that they were hidden in society by turning them into a game, so that far into the future, people would be able to figure it out if they were the right kind of people. And he wrote about this in a book called The Primeval World. He just had a little bit in that book. But he wrote about that, and it sort of went from there into becoming a magical device. But if you look at Renaissance figures that are associated with magic, they never talk about cardomancy at all. So it clearly was not a thing in the Renaissance, as far as I can tell. Now, there are certain people that would disagree with me on that, and they would offer some evidence to suggest maybe magic and cards do go back to the Renaissance, but there's nothing really solid there. And then once you get into the early 1800s, it really takes off from there. People, once they have it in mind that the cards do have these magical connotations, they begin to kind of insert it into the cards and graft it on there. And it really worked well. You know, I mean, the idea of strength, for example, being meaningful, that's obvious, right? And if you want to apply that to, say, fortune telling, why wouldn't it work? To me, it seems as if the cards have something in common with a lot of other big things, big ideas and institutions in society, where they can mean what people want them to mean. They can be adapted into different kinds of circumstances or concepts. And you have a lot of syncretistic elements with the cards, just as you do with like religion, you know. Just as in Christianity, we could take this really pagan idea of Easter eggs or Christmas trees, and it works great for the faith as an institution or as a cultural thing. Similarly, with the cards, magic seemed to breathe a tremendous amount of life, even a change of identity into what had just been a simple game.
And it's really interesting. You talk about that, and throughout the earlier chapters and that sort of first part about this history and the evolution, you talk a bit about those ways that people have used the card for different purposes. I think that often there's this idea of, and you talk about this, that sort of mystic that practices tarot, you know, in the tent kind of thing. But then there's the reality of it with the people who practice tarot. And so you talk a bit about that idea of all those different ways, like in psychology, in, you know, in different. And so I'd love, I mean, just because you started there, I'd love for you to talk a little bit about how, who those people are. We're sort of jumping ahead in chapter, but I, that's okay. Who those people are that sort of practice and use tarot and what you found there.
Well, psychology is a great place to look for that. I'm a big fan of interdisciplinary scholarship. And so looking at psychology as it relates to tarot is really good. You know, there's a, back in the 1940s, there was a psychologist named Bertram Forer. And Forer developed something that came to be called the Forer effect, which is basically if you tell people things that are sort of generalized, but more positive than negative, and you're just describing like personality traits, people will latch onto that in a way that feels personally identifying. So there's a common experiment that's been done where you could get, say, a classroom full of students and give them or ask them their birthday and year, and then have someone posing as an astrologer write up a brief summary of their personality traits, bring it back next week, and hand it to these individuals. And most of them, maybe even all of them, will say, yeah, that really does describe me. And then they'll ask to hand the paper to the student behind them or beside them or whatever. And it turns out everybody's got the same thing. So there is something about us and how our, I'll say a normal person's mind, whatever normal may mean, but a normal person's mind is going to find things that feel very individualized, very personalized, but they're actually general and applicable to other people. And so psychologists found that out in the 40s. And then there are things like the Rorschach test, which most people are familiar with, that where you look at a picture and it means something to you. It's not necessarily that you have to guess a correct interpretation. It just triggers a thought. And whatever thoughts are triggered, whatever we want to talk about in regular conversations, they're always going to reflect something about us, aren't they? I mean, whatever we choose to discuss, whether we're angry about something or happy or bragging or lamenting, whatever comes out is a revelation to some minor degree about who we are and what we're about. And so you can do that with the cards, just as you can do it with another psychological tool called the thematic apperception test. The thematic apperception test basically has pictures, a series of pictures that are sort of maybe mundane circumstances or very ambiguous images. They can include people, they could include, you know, a room or something like that. And the individual is asked to arrange the pictures in a sequence and then tell a story. And in doing so, they're going to reveal something about their mindset, right? But think about that next to tarot cards, which are just pictures arranged in a sequence that tell a story and give us something to think about that can then in turn tell us something about how we think. So psychologists have been able to use tarot cards. There's an interesting one by the name of Arthur Rosengarten, who practices in California. And he has used tarot cards for, you know, clients that have an interest in that or a willingness and openness to do it, just to get people thinking. And he's done work with people who are facing terminal illnesses. He's done some interesting group dynamics. I talk in the book about how he engaged this group of women that had an internal conflict in their therapy group, where there were some women who wanted it to be about moving beyond whatever trauma had brought them together, and then, you know, establishing a new life with themselves as friends with a common background, but they didn't really like talking about it. And then there was another group or another subsection within the group that felt that's the opposite of what they need, that what they needed was more discussion of the thing that the bond that they had. And it wasn't, you know, this group had been together for a significant amount of time before Rosengarten got involved. But in his tarot readings, what came out was that you have this division within the group about how they see the purpose of that group. And once that was out, the ability to resolve that problem became available and they could move forward.
It's right. Like, and I think it's really interesting how you have found these different ways in which tarot is used. I love that, you know, what you said about the pictures telling the story, right? And the importance of the story. And one of the things that I think in, and you bring it up often, and the evolution of tarot is that there's certain decks that are now made tarot really important. And I appreciate that you call it the White Coleman Smith deck instead of the Rider White deck. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that deck and sort of what brought tarot into the 19th, 20th centuries, right? What it brought it into our sort of modern era.
Yeah. So the deck that we're talking about is kind of the deck. You know, there are probably well over 1,000 different tarot decks available right now, but everybody knows this one, and everyone that's into tarot knows this one. It's usually the most familiar to people. I'm sure it's the top selling deck and everything. But two members of the Golden Dawn, which was this, you know, secret organization associated with magic in 1890s, early 1900s in England, Arthur Edward Waite and Pamela Coleman Smith decided they were going to make a deck that used one of these Italian Renaissance era decks called the Sola Busca deck for the what we call a minor arcana. So maybe I should explain first. A tarot deck is sort of two decks in one, in a sense. There are 78 total cards, but you have the major arcana, 20 some odd cards that have names like the devil, the tower, the moon, and so on. But then you have suit cards, which are just like the more familiar ones of instead of hearts and spades and clubs and diamonds, it's coins or pentacles, wands, and cups. And so you've got, you know, ace through 10. And then instead of jack, queen, king, it is page, knight, queen, king. And so that's how the decks are composed. Now, what Waite and Smith decided to do after looking at the Sola Busca deck, they decided that the minor arcana, those suit cards, should have imagery on them that's, you know, symbolic and strong, and instead of just the, say, three coins on the three of coins, right? Instead of a picture of just three coins, they're going to put something else there. And in doing that, it made not only a more beautiful deck, but it also made it easier to consider the meaning of an individual card in the minor arcana. And it ended up becoming a bestseller such that by the late 1960s, early 1970s, it was showing up really everywhere within the context of the New Age movement at that time, but also, you know, beyond that, right? And so there was a woman by the name of Eden Gray. And in the early 1970s, Eden Gray wrote a book on tarot cards that became an important book in the history of this genre, if I can call it that, because it was really clear as an instruction manual, and it was illustrated with the Waite Coleman Smith deck. And I think that just boosted the popularity of the deck even more as Eden Gray's book became well known. But I call it the Wake Coleman Smith deck. It's more formally or traditionally known as the Rider-Waite deck. And Rider is the name of the publisher. And Waite was, the guy that he's credited with designing the concepts of the cards, but not the actual illustrations. Pamela Coleman Smith, I think for many generations, was sort of undercredited for her role in this. She had a much more significant role than what she either got paid for or got credit for. And in recent years, tarotists like Mary Kay Greer, who's a pretty prominent person in that field, have done a lot of work to, rehabilitate Pamela Coleman Smith's reputation. And so I'm following suit with her. I'm definitely a big believer that the woman deserves credit because she did a heck of a thing. I mean, it's a really nice deck. The art is simplistic, but it is also strong, and it's easier to use, but it's also the kind of thing that allows a tarot reader to do much more than just memorize this card means this thing. You do get certain feelings evoked from the images on those cards, and she had a masterful way artistically to balance out whatever universal meaning should be in an image with whatever personal impact that image could have for a reader.
And I know this isn't, you don't really go into this in your book because it's, but I'm really interested as you're talking about that relationship between the person who sort of creates the concept and the artist, right? And there always seems to be, or there often seems to be two people in the, one doing the art and one doing the creation. And I'm not sure if there's anything with that you have seen or want to sort of talk about a little.
You know, you could apply that to the a deck called the Thoth deck that Aleister Crowley did with Lady Freda Harris. And Freda Harris, again, as is the case with Pamela Coleman Smith, has gotten more credit as time went on than she did initially for the artwork. And I guess Crowley's the idea guy, but I'm sure that does happen quite a bit. Sometimes a person can have a great idea and just not be able to execute it visually. So you would want to go to an artist, but there are a lot of occasions where an individual, especially if they have been in tarot for a little while and they've got fallen in love with it and they want to make their own deck if they've got an art skill. So my son, for example, this is not in the book, but my son very recently came out with a deck of his own called the Ink Witch Tarot. And he started off just on social media. There was an Inktober where an artist would do a couple pictures every day for a whole month. And he decided he's going to focus on some ideas for tarot. And after he did that, he decided he's going to make a whole deck. And it's really something how the people who do these decks, I can imagine that what happens to almost all of them is that certain ideas are almost, too easy. And then as you get into your 10th, 15th, 20th, 30th card, at some point, if you would say, I just don't know what to do for this one, So if you wanted to have, say, comic characters in a tarot deck and you wanted them to be Marvel comic characters, maybe it's easy to say Doctor Strange should be the magician card. But then you don't know who you'd want for maybe your Three of Swords or or something like that. So it's an incredible mental exercise. And I think the same would have been true for those early Renaissance artists who were making these tarot decks of course, for them, each deck is done, you know, by hand. And nowadays it's, you know, we have such an ability to produce on scale that that is a very different thing in that way. But I think that mentally and artistically, the process of coming up with a new deck has changed very little.
Mm-hmm. And so these, we have these decks, right? People are using them, and then they come to America, right? You sort of talk about how we get them here in the U.S. So can you talk a little bit about that, how the decks get to America and how they sort of get marketed in the United States?
Sure. Yeah, that's a little bit difficult for me to explain, but I'll try it like this. I think that when Waite and Coleman Smith came out with their deck, it was around the same time that Aleister Crowley had sort of blown up the Golden Dawn, which you know, prided itself on secrecy and a sort of elitism. And so much was exposed to the public that it sort of reshuffled the deck, so to speak. And they had this wider exposure. And so that deck finds its way to America. And by that time, you know, America had its own secret societies too in the late 1800s, not as prevalent as they would have been in France or in England. But America, culturally speaking, didn't really embrace the idea of magic as an elitist thing in the way that the British did. So you had popularizers of magic, people like Paul Foster Case or C.C. Zane, who kind of put various forms of personalized kind of magic as meditation or magic at, you know, the ability to see into the future or gain some spiritual recognition or in some cases sexual magic too. But once the culture of the United States was able to engage with these tarot cards, it took on a bit of a different meaning. And the fact that they were from Europe gave them a sort of an exotic feel as well. So they were attractive in that way too. And then by the time you get into the late 1960s, early 1970s, and you have this New Age movement, which was embracing just a diverse range of interests in whether it was Buddhism or Taoism from Asia, or whether it was beliefs about ancient Egyptians and Native Americans and, you know, the age of Aquarius and with astrological interest being piqued. Tarot fit in so well with that. And at that point, the Waite Coleman Smith deck had a solid niche and was ready to be turned into something enormous, as I said, with the work of Eden Gray.
And you mentioned this multiple times, but and I think when anyone who's even seen a tarot deck knows that tarot is, there's just art. The deck is art itself, right? And so in that second sort of part of the book, you start to, you know, you give us this history and then move into some of the ways we see this in popular culture. And so I'd love for you to talk a bit more about that art, like how tarot is art and how it's used. You talk about the Salvador Dali's deck and different sort of decks, but I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that role of art in tarot.
Thank you. Yeah, that was an important chapter for me, and it was challenging for me to research that one, not so much in terms of finding material, but in terms of coming up with a context, because art, to begin with, is one of these terms like beauty or goodness where it doesn't necessarily mean the same thing to me as it does to you. And yet we use those words with each other as if there's no problem communicating an equal understanding. And it's not really like that. So one of the things that I would point out is that people often think of art as having these two levels, like there's low art and high art, if you will. And if somebody was to make a tarot deck with gummy bears on it, I don't know that we can call that art, right? But on the other hand, we have people, for example, there's a deck that uses Edward Blake's art, and no one's going to make an honest claim that Blake wasn't a great artist. So to put his art on the deck must mean that that deck has great art. I just don't see a way of arguing against that. You could also see, as you meant, like Salvador Dali made a deck for his wife. And Salvador Dali is recognized as a great artist, although some people don't like him, of course. You know, it's subjective stuff. But if a prominent artist makes a deck, then how could you say it isn't? You know, if we look at the Thoth deck that I mentioned earlier, and you can see, for example, Picasso's cubism shows up in certain cards in that deck that Aleister Crowley and Lady Frieda Harris made. The Tower card is very much a cubist rendering. I talk about Picasso's Guernica painting and how the eye in that is incorporated into Crowley's Tower card. The work of Pamela Coleman Smith fits into artistic movements of her time period that have had a lasting effect. And so, you know, in the Renaissance era, when cards were first being made, they were handcrafted by artists. And in at least one case, there was an artist that made plates so that others could be made from the same device. But I think that there's some powerful imagery, particularly religious imagery, that shows up in the art and tarot cards. So, for example, the Book of Kells, the early medieval Irish gospel, has these images of the four evangelists, the gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, symbolized by an angel, an ox, a lion, and an eagle. And in some of the tarot cards, there's a couple of the tarot cards where you see those very images placed in the corners of the card. So they're incorporating very sincerely religious artistic imagery. And I think that that suggests to us that as a medium, it's very conducive to, you know, to distributing art out into the wider culture. But then again, some people might say that if you mass produce it, it's not art. And I don't try to tackle that debate. I think that, you know, I mean, in my office, I have a print of Caravaggio's Doubting Thomas hanging on the wall, and a picture of David's Death of Socrates hanging on my office wall. And it's just pictures that were copied, you know. It's obviously not the original, although sometimes I will tell my students, I stole the original and here it is. I take it from a museum. Don't tell anybody. but it's not. And so is it still art, right? I would argue that it is, but I would also add to that, that if you disagree with me, that's fine, but there's plenty of room to disagree because art is a very personal and subjective thing. It matters to people. It evokes feelings. It provokes discussion and debate. It gets us thinking and it gets us feeling. And that's really what art is supposed to do. So at that level, one should look at tarot as genuine art. There's also the possibility of taking tarot and incorporating it into something that is artistic. So if an artist is painting a scene in a room where there is a tarot reader or a deck of cards, and tarot is now in the art. Tarot is literally the art. So we can look at it and approach it from any number of ways. And I try to be mindful of that in that chapter while also showing you know, several different kinds of decks and the stories behind those.
And I really appreciated that chapter and what you're saying, partly because of that idea that I think there's beautiful, right? People buy decks for the imagery on them. But my favorite deck right now is one where I actually have prints, right, from the artist that she's made that represent the deck, right? So she's taken the art in her tarot, but also made prints, right? So I think, and they're hanging on my wall, right? That's art.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate that, like thinking about art and thinking about how tarot is art in those ways. And that, I mean, you talk about the British Museum having prints of one deck, right? A deck. And so the importance of that historically, right? You can go to a museum and find these, you can find tarot and you can find these prints in the museums as well. So that high art versus low art. Even.
Right.
So you sort of set this up and then you move into really thinking about tarot and television and then film and comics. So let's start with television because that's sort of where you start. And a bit about how you've seen tarot's place in television.
I think it's got a handful of good functions for storytelling in general, whether that's television, comics, or movies. If a lot of people have a sense of, let's say, fear or hostility or sort of anguish over tarot cards, then you can use that by using tarot cards as a prop. And, you know, we see that happening over and over. You can also sort of connect a card to a character. And, you know, so if you have the Fool card, for example, and you want a character to seem foolish, well, obviously, you know, the link is made instantly, right? But I think they're also really good for foreshadowing. You know, if they're associated, there's association with fortune telling in tarot cards. So if you have somebody's fortune being read, then you, right there, you're creating, you know, a story and an ending. You just have the characters play it out. It's also something to me to see how many different kinds of shows used tarot. You'd expect it in a show, in certain shows, like I'm trying to think of.
Well, like Buffy, I think you said, like you'd expect it in something like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, right?
Right, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, thank you, yeah. And but you wouldn't really expect it in Andy Griffith, would you?
Right, no, that was so funny. Yeah, it was like, I must have seen, I remember, I used to love watching Andy Griffith a long time, and I was like, I must have seen it, but I just, yes, it was one of those, oh.
Yeah, and that was 1964, so it's really before the New Age movement. And it shows you that at the cultural level, tarot had a place in television. As far as I know, the first place that it shows up was on an old Western series. And I think it's called The Lawman. And they used the hangman card to, you know, create a sense of, da-da, you know, something bad's going to happen. And it shows up in animated series two, The Simpsons used it, and King of the Hill, which was, I used to just love King of the Hill. It was one of my favorite shows. And I remember when the character Bobby got into tarot card reading. And, you know, I thought that was cute and funny. And, you know, part of this is odd to me because tarot's place in culture, broadly speaking, is very limited, right? Like there's a certain group of people in society that you might expect to be associating with tarot, but not us decent normal folk, right? And so for the rest of people, they can have these preconceived notions about tarot, and you can use those and can be very entertaining. You can use those to criticize people who criticize tarot, or you can use those to criticize tarot. whatever you want to do, it works. And I think that that range is a very useful thing, because while it's very flexible in this way, it's also very strong in that the reactions people have to it. Like if somebody's opposed to tarot and they want to see tarot getting dragged through the mud in a television show, it would be very gratifying for them. On the other hand, if somebody is very into tarot and they see it being used and used well on a show, that too would be very gratifying. So on the one hand, it's neutral, right? Like you can do whatever you want with it. On the other hand, people have strong feelings about it one way or the other. And so it's able to provide a sort of a powerful sense of emotion or attitude when it does get deployed in a television program.
I thought you had this one, you were talking about the use in Mad Men, right? And I thought that was really interesting because the show producers, right, and creator uses tarot, right, talks about his use of tarot, and actually you have a one shot of a reading for Don Draper that was actually the reading that the creator had gotten, right? I think that's really interesting too, that, you know, when you talk about like bringing tarot in and how it's used.
Yeah, so the show's creator is able to incorporate experiences from his own life and then apply them to Don Draper as the main character in the series, and do it in a way that really worked well. In that reading, we do get this encapsulated moment where our understanding of the main character's attitude towards relationships is kind of revealed. And so the viewer already knows a lot about Don Draper at that point. And that reading kind of tells you a bit about him as a person. But it goes beyond that and suggests a direction that his life is moving in. And that's what a tarot reading offers typically. But when we apply it to a specific character, it helps to develop that character and to develop the story arc that it's being inserted into as well.
And it's interesting when you film and television are two birds of the same feather, or completely opposite, depending on who you talk to. But it was interesting. It saw it a little bit in your television chapter, but in your movie chapter, even more so, how tarot is altered, right? Like, or the traditional ways that tarot is altered in order to fit the purposes of the narrative. Like I'm thinking of the James Bond and using the tarot and sort of creating like the 78 lover cards, right? So you flip the deck and you're going to get the card you want, right? Yeah. So I think that's really interesting. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about how you saw the ways in which tarot has been altered or used in that way to change the narrative.
Yeah, I think the James Bond movie with, I'm trying to remember the actress's name.
Was it Jane Seymour? Was she the one in that one?
Yeah. Yes. Jane Seymour, beautiful young lady, is paired up with James Bond, who Roger Moore was well into his 40s at that point. So I think that's a little bit creepy to me, but I'm still a James Bond fan nonetheless. And I thought it was amusing that he is able to manipulate the tarot reader because James Bond, he knows how to do things and he's so smart and everything like that. So he uses her device against her. We see something similar in a Sherlock Holmes Game of Shadows movie, where Robert Downey Jr. plays Sherlock Holmes, and there's a character in there, Madame Simza, who reads tarot, and Holmes goes in to get his fortune read, and he wants to really upstage her. and takes the deck from her and starts reading hers. And of course, he already knows something about her, and he's going to use that and use the cards in combination with that to kind of assert himself. But in the case of Madame Simza, unlike with Jane Seymour's character, she's a much stronger woman. And she has this mental toughness that makes her more than just a match for him. And it comes out in that scene using those cards. And even the cards themselves, the art on the cards, has some historical connection to a deck that would have been in existence at the time of that the movie is set in. So I thought that was really interesting too. It wasn't exactly that deck, but you could tell the artwork was inspired by that. So, you know, they're sort of using the cards to shape, to tell us something about the characters and about the relationships between the characters in a way that's highly effective. I mean, you could do that in other ways. Characters always have to be built. Relationships always have to be built within the context of a movie. But the tarot deck and individual tarot cards or a tarot reading, all of these things can be used very well to perform that function in a movie. There's one movie that if you don't mind me talking about, that's might not be well known to most people because it's 1947 is when it came out, but Nightmare Alley, which is a film noir, it involves a whole series of different kinds of magic, magical things that are all scams and cons. But within that movie, the one sort of supernatural thing that isn't a fake is the tarot cards. And I believe that's the only movie that does a thing like that, that at least that I'm familiar with, where, you know, magic is associated with not just stage magicians, but with con men in a number of different ways. And then yet this one very stereotypical magical device, this deck of tarot cards, is put into a very different kind of context. And I thought that was a really interesting movie and an interesting way of using the tarot.
Yeah, I think you have given me some like the Red Violin you talk about too, like some movies to my summer watch.
Right? Oh, great. Yeah, Red Violin's impressive.
And I thought, you know, I saw the Red Violin, but it was probably, it was what, 20 years ago, right? Or yeah, probably, right? 20 years ago or so. I keep forgetting we're in 2021, right? Like, and so I'm like, you know, going back to that film, and if I can find Nightmare Alley, I'm sure I can, right? But, you know, I'm like, I want to watch these again and sort of look for that and see how that sort of plays out in those different roles. And then you sort of...
Yeah, I can... Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, in Red Violin, that movie had been out for a while before I ever heard of it. And I came across it while researching this book. And so watched it for that purpose. And I was really impressed. You know, they use tarot in ways that you'd expect. So it can foreshadow things, right? But they're telling multiple stories simultaneously in there. And they're doing it in a way that didn't leave me confused, which I really appreciated that. You know, I'm not a big fan of like flashbacks, flash forward, flashback again, go to the present. Yeah, that I just, I get frustrated with that sort of thing. But this movie takes us through time, you know, from, I want to say, I think it's 1600s Italy up to present day when it came out. It follows this violin that has a connection to a woman that dies at the beginning of the story. But the tarot cards are seemingly at one level telling the story of the woman who died, and at another level telling the story of that violin. And the reader is, I mean, the viewer is then sort of immersed in the tarot card reading, but at the same time, you're traveling through time, and all the stories connected to that violin are interesting stories too. And so we follow really simultaneous, or, you know, at one and the same time, we're getting like three stories told to us in a way that's not hard to follow, but has this rich complexity to it that is very engaging to me.
Well, yes, I remember watching that film and loving that how the story was woven, but the tarot was right now. I want to go back to it and watch for that. So that's on my list. Your final right. sort of chapter is about comics, right? And this sort of returns to art. I mean, I find comics to be art. But I'd love for you to talk about sort of what you found with tarot, both in more popular like Marvel, DC, you know, comics, but also with what Neil Gaiman was doing, and that, and the work of Rachel Pollack is as a tarotist and as a comic writer.
Yeah, and Neil Gaiman and Rachel Pollack, it turns out they are well acquainted. And so they have worked together in different ways, which I thought was really fascinating. I would not have imagined those two having a connection, but I thought that was really cool. I'm a big fan of Rachel Pollack. I had an opportunity to interview her and Mary Greer during the course of making this book. And Mary Greer was kind enough to give me a blurb on the back of the book cover. But Rachel Pollack's 78 Degrees of Wisdom is one of these really important books in the body of tarot literature. But her work in comics gave her a chance to make connections with certain kinds of readers that I think are numerically not significant in terms of sales or audience size, but I think emotionally and personally significant. Rachel Pollack, you may know, is trans, and one of her characters she wrote a good sequence of a comic that had a trans character in it. And so it gave her an opportunity in the 1990s, at a time where this was a difficult topic for society to digest for whatever reasons. And she told me that she had gotten mail from a young reader that felt some sense of connection and comfort by, you know, being able to read that comic. And I think traditionally comics have actually provided that. You could look at a character like Captain America, who starts off, I'm a very well-known superhero, right? But he starts off as a real weak guy who can't fight, wishes he could be something more, and he miraculously gets that opportunity, and it brings out the best of this person. And so how many little boys reading comics, you know, can live vicariously through that? Comics are important in that way. It might be simple. I could see people ridiculing that notion, but tough crap for them. It, you know, the fact of the matter is it matters to people at certain levels. And so Rachel Pollack was able to do something important in that way, even if the rest of the world doesn't notice it much. That's the problem with the rest of the world. But then you've got, I mean, Neil Gaiman, enormously successful writer, enormously influential, and he decided to write a series of comics that have a character that looks disturbingly like J.K. Rowling.
Yeah, Harry Potter.
Yeah. But this is before Harry Potter. This is before Harry Potter. And he incorporates all kinds of the DC characters into, or I guess maybe I should say Vertigo, which is a subset of DC. They're incorporated into his series, and it's done extremely well. I mean, if you like Neil Gaiman, you're going to like that. What got me about it was the way that he uses tarot to tell a story in a context that I don't want to give something away on it, but I'll say it like this. All of our lives fit into something bigger and more longer lasting, right? All of our lives are started at a point where so much has already gone on and will come to an end at a point where so much more is yet to come. And he found a way to present that to the reader and incorporate tarot into the process, which I thought was interesting. Like a lot of stories, time travel is part of that too. And so is this quest, or not so much a quest as a decision that's made in life, where the main character has to decide, where do you stand? What kind of person are you going to be? You have all this potential in your life. What are you going to do with it? And, you know, that's always a great device or element to incorporate into a novel or a comic or whatever it may be. And it's done while it's done in a way that incorporates tarot. I think a lot of times when people look at tarot, they see the fortune telling aspect of it. It's supposed to be decisive, right? Like, you will die at 4:30 on, Tuesday, March 18th and whatever year, right? And of course, it's not that way. It can't be that way. But this isn't unless you want it to be something to discredit tarot, go ahead. But I think that what tarot readers generally do is to suggest potential trends or ongoing circumstances that one can expect to face, and then put the querent, the person asking the questions, into a frame of mind that is ready to address that. You know, should I face this circumstance, I will decide to do it in this way. It's not that you will face this circumstance at this specific time and in this specific place and way. It's more like, think about this in your life. And, you know, the imagery on the cards is really derived from circumstances in all of our lives. The idea, like I've mentioned the strength card more than once at this point, but there are certain circumstances where we need strength, and we define that in all kinds of ways. It's not necessarily physical toughness, of course. It's maybe the ability to stand up to a bully, or the willingness to not follow along with your group when they're making a bad decision. Or maybe it's just, facing the death of a loved one and somehow figuring a way to move on from that. So if that card comes up, it will come up in a meaningful way. That's just all there is to it. They are meaningful because of what's on the card. And if you are a normal person, again, whatever that means, I don't really know, but whatever a normal person is, when they are presented with an image that is significant, meaningful, and relevant, then they now have something important to ponder. And in that way, I think the cards were used well by Neil Gaiman, Rachel Pollack, people who make comics or movies or TV shows, because the cards work well for that sort of thing.
I have to say, I'm so glad that you sort of said that and wrapped that up, because when I will read the tarot, I'll say, you need to tell me your question and think about that question. And then I'm going to look at the cards and talk about them in relation to that, so that you can think about like what is right, like that. That wraps it up so well. That idea, I think for me, we've been talking a while, so I usually ask if there's something you're working on now, I mean, I think this just came out, so it might, you know, you might not be, or if there's something with your book that you sort of, you know, one last kind of anything you want to promote or get out there or share.
Oh, wow. I wasn't expecting that. So I'm not.
You might not. I always used to.
I have to say I'm not, I haven't started another project. I have a handful of ideas bouncing around in my head about what to do next. And I'll have to narrow that down to one at some point. I'm really not sure. I guess, you know, I'm enjoying the fact that I am done with this and it's behind me now. because, well, I mean, it was a labor of love, but it was a lot of labor. It's the first time I had a book published. So it was a kind of a taxing process, but in many ways an enjoyable one. I'm really glad that it came out. And I do have like a bit of sense of accomplishment. It's sort of like a trophy when somebody writes a book. It's sort of like getting a trophy. But then it's done and over with, and you have to go on to the next thing. So I'm not quite sure what that will be yet. It might not even be within the realm of magic or popular culture. I just don't know.
That's fine. Well, it's been great talking to you, Patrick. It was Patrick Maley, author of The Cards, The Evolution and Power of Tarot. And this is New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture. Thanks again.
Thank you. I really appreciate your time. I enjoyed it myself. It was fun talking to you.